The headlines this hour. The U.S. military slams recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing amid recent tensions over Taiwan. The White House National Security Advisor says Washington's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. And Bangladesh sends hundreds more Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island, despite opposition from rice groups. Hello, welcome. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. military has slammed recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing. The U.S. military's Pacific Command says the flights over the past week are, quote, aggressive behavior. It says, however, the fighter jets posed no threat to a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group in the region. The group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea recently amid tensions between China and Taiwan. The new U.S. administration reaffirms Washington's support for Taiwan after Beijing warned the self-ruled island against any attempts to seek independence from mainland China. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the mounting tensions with our guests.
On this news review, the Pentagon has reaffirmed its support to Taiwan's self-defense after China said independence for the island means war. The remarks were the first by President Joe Biden's military about China-Taiwan tensions since he took office last week. Those tensions have been escalating in the past months as the U.S. increased support to Taiwan. The support included deals selling arms to the self-ruled island. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to U.S. support for it. China sees U.S. measures as a violation of the One China policy and interference in its internal affairs. Taiwan wants independence from China. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have a senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, Mr. John Ross, joining us from London. Also, we have journalist and author Daniel Azar, who's with us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ross in London. Sir, how do you perceive this constant support that the United States is giving to Taiwan?
Well, the United States is increasing its support to Taiwan. For the first time, the Taiwanese representative in the United States was invited to Biden's inauguration. This was the first time since the establishment of formal diplomatic relations between China and the United States at the end of the 1970s. So this is deliberate escalation of the situation by the United States. I mean, what it will do is greatly increase tension. There's not I doubt that there's a single person in China, I've certainly never met one, who doesn't think that Taiwan is part of China. So these are very provocative actions by the United States.
Mr. Lazar, do you agree with that? These are very provocative actions as the U.S. seems to be increasing its support for Taiwan right now.
Well, the U.S. is engaging in provocative actions around the world, Western Pacific, in the Persian Gulf, in Latin America, vis-a-vis Venezuela and Nicaragua, and elsewhere. The problem is the U.S. Empire is under growing strain. It's grossly overextended. So as a result, it finds itself more and more heavily engaged in a wide variety of theaters. And sooner or later, it'll lead to trouble. The empire is overextended, as I said. It's militarily stretched. And there simply is no way that things can't end up going badly in one or two or three hotspots.
Right. John Ross, what kind of a response are you expecting to see now from Beijing, having in mind that there's a new administration in Washington as of last week?
Well, I don't think that the question of the new administration will make a big difference, because China's policy on Taiwan is not determined by who is the present president of the United States. Taiwan is an integral part of China and will eventually return to China. China's quite well aware of that. The relation of forces all the time, not merely economically, but increasingly militarily, moves in the direction of China. It's made its position clear that a declaration of independence by Taiwan will mean war. And that's not bluff, not rhetoric or anything, that's just the position. For that reason, incidentally, I'm not as sure that the United States wants to support Taiwan independence at all. The danger is that it's making itself hostage to some very irresponsible people in Taiwan who themselves have every interest in making provocations in the situation. So the danger is China's, not that China's going to change its policy, the danger is the situation will get out of control due to activities by people who want to have separatism in Taiwan, which has got no chance of success, whatever.
Mr. Lazar, what do you think about that? Do you think that there is a chance for the situation escalating? And also, how important of a part does this issue of Taiwan play when we're looking at China and Washington relations and the tit for tat we've been seeing with these two countries over the past couple of years?
Well, there are flashpoints up and down the Western Pacific. The South China Sea is one of the most important ones. I mean, something like 40% of the world's freight traffic passes through the South China Sea, and the U.S. is engaged in an immense struggle for control over that crucial waterway. So that's a potential flashpoint. Taiwan is, the Korean Peninsula is, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, forces are pushing for a confrontation. And the U.S. Is unfortunately adopting an ambiguous position in which it winds up encouraging such tendencies. So yeah, the danger is quite real. It's growing, and things could very easily spin out of control.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, speaking to us from New York. Also, thanks to Mr. John Ross, senior fellow at the Chongyang Institute, speaking to us from London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the Newsroom. Bye for now.
The U.S. and South Korea plan to carry out joint military exercises this spring, drawing international calls for the drills to be suspended. Nearly 400 activist organizations in South Korea and around the world signed a joint statement calling on the new U.S. President Joe Biden to suspend the exercises, even as military officials in Seoul and Washington suggested the maneuvers would go ahead. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before in the early 1990s as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018. The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The top aide to U.S. President Joe Biden says the new administration's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The White House National Security Advisor claimed that Tehran is moving, quote, closer to having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Jake Sullivan made the remarks as the Biden administration has signaled that it wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal the previous administration had abandoned. Sullivan did not mention Biden's often stated precondition that Iran make the first move by resuming its full compliance with its commitments under the deal. Iran has underlined that it was the U.S. that unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 deal and therefore it needs to take the first step by lifting sanctions and complying with the terms of the agreement. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara have a common stance that the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed his talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu as constructive, friendly, and fruitful. Zarif also noted the ways to expand bilateral ties, regional cooperation, and the latest developments in Syria, Iraq, and the Caucasus were among main topics discussed in the talks. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a Twitter post at the end of his visit to Turkey.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
Iran, ABD.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Afghan security personnel are killed as a bomber drives a vehicle loaded with explosives into a military base in the country's east. The pre-dawn assault took place in the western province of Nangarhar. The provincial council confirmed the attack, but put the number of dead soldiers at 15. The Taliban militant group has claimed responsibility. The attack came 2 days after the Pentagon said that the Taliban were not living up to promises made in a deal signed with Washington last year. Under the agreement, the U.S. pledged to withdraw its forces from the country. In return, the Taliban agreed to not allow extremists to operate from the country and give some security guarantees. Violence has surged in recent months, despite Doha peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Bangladesh has sent another batch of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite opposition from rights groups. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. This is the newest addition to the roughly 3,500 refugees already sent to the island since early December. Dhaka claims it is only moving those who are willing to leave the overcrowded camps in the town of Cox's Bazar. However, humanitarian groups say the refugees have been forced to leave. The UN has also criticized the relocation, saying the world body has not been allowed to evaluate the living conditions on the flood-prone island. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims crossed into Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown on the stateless ethnic minority group in 2017. Indian police have tightened security as thousands of new protesters arrived near the capital to join farmers agitating the government's controversial agricultural reforms. Authorities have also blocked internet services in areas where the farmers have set up their camps. Meanwhile, the protesters have gone on a day-long mass hunger strike on the death anniversary of the country's independence icon, Mahatma Gandhi. They say that the action is to show the peacefulness of their agitation. Rallies and sit-ins are ongoing for months. This week, a tractor rally on Republic Day turned violent, leaving one person dead and hundreds injured. The farmers want the government to repeal the legislation passed in September, arguing that it would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between farmers and government representatives have failed to make a breakthrough. A team of experts led by the World Health Organization, tasked with investigating the origins of COVID-19, has begun field visits in the Chinese city of Wuhan after a two-week quarantine. The team paid a visit to one of Wuhan's main hospitals, which treated patients in the early stages of the pandemic. The team is also scheduled to visit labs, markets, and other hospitals during its remaining days in the city. Despite international outcry, Israeli regime continues to deny Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip with COVID-19 vaccines. Palestinians are saying that this is part of Israeli policy to exert more pressure on them. Ruba Shabit has more.
Israeli occupation has denied COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israeli parliament said Palestinians living under Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip will receive no vaccine. Palestinians say the move is aimed at pressurizing resistance groups to release Israeli soldiers arrested during the Israeli aggression imposed against the Strip since 2014.
Israel's aggressive policies are unacceptable, and Palestinians will resist these inhumane policies. The Israeli announcement to deny vaccines to Gaza is totally unacceptable. The resistance groups will remain steadfast in their fight against the occupation and have prepared themselves for all possible scenarios.
This comes as Israeli Health Ministry has said over a quarter of Israel's population have received the vaccine since December 19. Human rights groups have accused Israeli regime of violating the basic rights of Palestinians.
Since the coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime has sought through all possible means to pressurize the resistance groups into sitting back. Israel has announced that no aid is allowed in the Gaza Strip without the release of their captured soldiers. Palestinians will never accept such a thing, and the Israeli occupation knows this well. Israel is now showing its racist face to the world by announcing this illegal and inhumane policy.
For their own part, Palestinian resistance groups in the Strip have said they will not sit back, adding release of Israeli soldiers should come through a just prisoner swap deal.
We announced that Israeli attempts to pressurize the resistance front into releasing its captured soldiers won't succeed. We are after a fair swap deal. We won't give in to pressure. Israel's attempts to tie vaccine entrance to soldier release will fail.
Earlier, the United Nations called on the Israeli regime to help ensure Palestinians will receive COVID-19 vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic, stressing that the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN said the cost of lives and livelihoods there remain high, particularly in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's move to deny vaccine to the Palestinians comes as over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with coronavirus and more than 1,800 have lost their lives so far. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
And that is for World News. This is bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
According to a poll, 56% of Americans approve and 42% disapprove of the House impeaching Trump for a second time, which happened on January 13th when members of the lower chamber of Congress passed an article charging the former president with high crimes and misdemeanors for his role in provoking the deadly mayhem at the Capitol. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Majority in U.S. Wants Senate to Convict Trump and Bar Him from Holding Office Ever Again. Stay tuned for the details, please. A clear majority of Americans want twice impeached former President Donald Trump to be convicted by the Senate and barred from holding office in the future. According to polling results released recently, the same day, the House of Representatives delivered an article of impeachment against Trump for incitement of insurrection to the upper chamber of Congress. The phone survey was conducted by Monmouth University Polling Institute, which interviewed 809 adults in the U.S. from January 21st to January 24th, roughly 2 weeks after a pro-Trump mob invaded the halls of Congress as lawmakers attempt to certify President Joe Biden's electoral victory. According to the poll, 56% of Americans approve and 42% disapprove of the House impeaching Trump for a second time, which happened on January 13th, when members of the lower chamber of Congress passed an article charging the former president with high crimes and misdemeanors for his role in provoking the deadly mayhem at the Capitol. All 222 House Democrats voted to impeach Trump, but only 10 House Republicans joined them, and the partisan divide is reflected in the survey results. While 92% of Democrats approve of Trump's second impeachment, support drops to 52% among independents and just a mere 13% among Republicans. More than half, that is about 52% of the U.S. public, wants the Senate to convict Trump on the impeachment charge versus 44% of Americans who do not. According to Monmouth, the level of support among Americans for disciplining Trump is slightly higher now than it was when the former president was impeached for the first time in January 2020. Last year, 49% backed removing Trump from office via an impeachment conviction, while 48% opposed such a move. Now, 57% want the Senate to take action to prevent Trump from holding federal office in the future, compared with 41% who are opposed. When respondents were informed that a ban on future office holding must be preceded by a conviction, the the support for a Senate conviction on the impeachment charge increased from 52% to 55%. There is somewhat more agreement that Trump did something wrong than there was with the first impeachment. But there are still a good number of Republican stalwarts who continue to stand with the former president regardless, said Patrick Murray, director of Monmouth. The January 6th riot was sparked by incessant GOP lies that the election was stolen, the false claims of Trump and his allies that Biden's victory was the result of widespread voter fraud, and therefore illegitimate, has had a lasting detrimental impact. The poll found that roughly one-third, about 32% of Americans, think Trump's defeat is attributable to fraud. Nearly 30 quarters, that is 72% of Republicans, continue to believe Biden won as a result of fraud. About two-thirds, that is 65% of the U.S. public, agrees that Biden won the election fair and square. Among those who still think Trump lost due to fraud, nearly two-thirds claim to want to move on. But one-third of this group, which represents 10% of the nation's adults, say they will never accept Biden as president. A number of ostensible leaders in the Republican Party continue to peddle this false narrative, and many more who know this claim is wrong have not been particularly outspoken in disavowing it, said Murray. Their fellow partisans in the American public are simply following that lead. The potential for Trump and his allies' lies to cause irreversible damage to democracy in the U.S. has prompted some lawmakers, including Representative Mondragon, to characterize Trump's Senate trial, which is set to begin on February 9th, as a life-or-death battle for the future of the country. Convicting Donald Trump to save our democracy is not a distraction, Jones tweeted recently, and added, it's essential.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari, a student of the Islamic Seminary of Qom. And today we are going to talk about why are problems and hardships ever present in the world we live in. Obviously, we do know that difficulties, hardships, and trials and tribulations exist, and they are everywhere. Even then, in the richest countries and the richest societies, we see that people suffer, people have different problems and different challenges facing in their day-to-day life. And these challenges are a cause of inconvenience, a cause of worry and concern for many people. So some people might want to say, okay, we worship God, we praise God, we glorify Him, we obey God, but still we suffer in our life. Why don't I have this and that? So there are people who are continuously and constantly complaining. Now, to begin with and to deal with this question, the question which I asked in the beginning, why are problems and hardships ever present in the world we live in? A passerby goes by a crystal glass shop and notices some drinking glasses on display placed upside down on the shop front. After looking at them for a little while, the passerby goes in, picks one of the glasses up and complains to the shopkeeper, asking why those glasses are sealed from the top and open from the bottom, you know. The shopkeeper smiles and says that if you look at it the right way and hold it the right way up, both of those problems will be resolved, you know. This is just an example to help us understand and learn things from other people's perspective, you know. If you start thinking about problems from your own personal perspective, you might not reach any conclusion. You will not get any answer. But we should note that there is wisdom behind everything. There is a philosophy, and there is actually hikmah behind every problem and hardship. These problems and hardships have their positive impacts and consequences on our life, and they are not futile in any way. Yes, indeed, many of the problems are based upon incorrect beliefs and ideas. We think that the world in which we live is for our convenience and comfort. We expect everything to be good, to look good for us. And so we ask why there is inconvenience, why there is, for example, discomfort, why is there so hardship, tragedy, and of course war going on, like for example someone sitting in a kebab restaurant and complaining as to why there is no shower there. Okay, this is just an example just to help our audience understand that sometimes we expect something and that is not in its place, you see. This example which I gave, the example of a person who sits in a restaurant expecting a shower to be there. Now, such an individual needs to understand and believe that the restaurant is not a bathroom, you see. So everything has to be expected in its right and in its proper place.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We too have to understand that the world is not a place to sleep. It is not a place for enjoyment or seeking pleasure. Rather, it is a place one must grow and develop and tackle hardships and attain perfection. And perfection is not achieved, of course, without hardship. The Quran says, فَأَخَذْنَاهُمْ بِالْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَضَرَّعُونَ. Now, this verse is very important. Verse Al-An'am, verse 42 of the Holy Quran, chapter 6. فَأَخَذْنَاهُمْ بِالْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَرَّعُونَ. And we seized them with misery and hardship that haply they might be humble. Okay? The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, لَوْلَا ثَلَاثَةٌ فِي إِبْنِ آدَمْ مَا طَأْتَ أَرَاسَهُ شَيْءٌ الْمَرَضُ وَالْمَوْتُ وَالْفَخْرِ. If it were not for three things, the son of Adam would not bow down his head. Those three things are, for example, death and sickness, illness, and poverty. Death, everybody dies, everybody falls sick, and most people, of course, encounter poverty in their lives. So these are the three things which make a person feel humble, you see, and bow down his head. The Holy Quran also says that فَخَذْنَاهُمْ بِالْبَأْسَاءِ وَضَرَّاءِ, we seized them with misery and hardship, with difficulty, لَعَلَّهُمْ يَتَذَكَّرُونَ, so that they might be humble. Now this is the goal, and this is the philosophy of hardship and difficulty and misery. It is true that a scent stick, unless burning, will not be able to release its fragrance. Okay, so hardship is a tool with which one can get rid of pride and vanity, of arrogance, of stubbornness, and this, of course, is one of the philosophy, one of the rationale of hardship and difficulties. And of course, hardship and difficulties, as I said, makes one's dormant potentialities, one's dormant capacity to awaken, and they are a blessing in disguise. Just the example of the flood which destroys our streets and lands, they seem to be a kind of tragedy, but they have a longer impact on our life, positive impact on the farmer's life, on our life, and on the life of the society. Now, imagine, I would like to give you another example. Imagine the example of the air that is pumped into the tires of cars. So it is something that the tire is, with which pressure is there inside the tire, you see. The example of the tire, the air pumped into the tire, is the example of hardships which are experienced by mankind. So hardship is necessary to regulate our life and normalize our life, and to help get rid of negligence, vanity. Unless we face a hardship in our life, we continue to remain negligent, we continue to remain arrogant and stubborn, and we will continue to be egotistical, and we will be proud in vain. So hardships, difficulties, bring about a situation conducive to new initiatives and inventions. Without hardships, we are lazy, we are, you see, lethargic, and we do not know what to do in our life, you see. But hardships make us think and work out in strategy and move forward. That's all for this session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Cause your love is all I need.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron has said Europe will not block or ban exports of coronavirus vaccines, but that they should be controlled, accusing AstraZeneca of a lack of transparency after the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company said it could not fulfill the whole of its contract with the European Union. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Macron Calls for COVID Vaccine Exports from EU to be Controlled. Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. French President Emmanuel Macron has said Europe will not block or ban exports of coronavirus vaccines, but that they should be controlled, accusing AstraZeneca of a lack of transparency after the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company said it could not fulfill the whole of its contract with the European Union. The French president insisted it was in everyone's interest for all countries to have access to vaccines. He also said the AstraZeneca vaccine, given approval by the European Union regulator on Friday for use on all adults, appeared to be quasi-ineffective on people older than 65, though Macron acknowledged he had no figures or official information. Last week, AstraZeneca enraged European Union officials by announcing that only 25% of the deliveries would be possible in the first quarter of 2021. Owing to production problems at the Belgian plant, and that it could not make good on the shortages by importing from the United Kingdom. Imagine the hypothesis that the British finish their vaccine campaign with success. What will they do? Stop European lorries from entering? Where there is a total dependence on the continent. Bon courage or good luck, Emmanuel Macron said. And imagine the hypothesis that France, Italy, Germany have a vaccine strategy that is extremely ambitious and rapid. It will quickly fail if our neighbors don't have the same vaccine strategy because our economies are integrated. France have 500,000 trans-border workers, so all of this will only work if we do it together. Speaking at the Elysee Palace, Emmanuel Macron said, vaccine exports should be controlled, not blocked or banned, which would make no sense because we're also dependent on non-European production. It should be controlled because there is questionable behavior and we will be receiving fewer deliveries that do not honor the contractual engagements agreed upon. He added that Europe's response to the contractual failure will be proportional. But we cannot have contractual agreements made with laboratories then reviewed because of pressure from one or other countries. The situation with vaccines is unusual, but I believe strongly in benefits of cooperation. AstraZeneca is a major laboratory that has its base in the United Kingdom, but it also has a very strong presence in France and Europe. There is no benefit to having a strategy of non-cooperation. There has been a lack of transparency in the lack of information given, particularly from AstraZeneca. We have doubts and we want to be sure that if a company is not able to honor its contract, it's not because it has over-delivered elsewhere. And that's why cooperation is so important, Emmanuel Macron said. The European Medicines Agency authorized the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine for use in all adult age groups on Friday, 26th of January, after German authorities had earlier recommended that its use be limited to people under the age of 65 due to a lack of data about efficacy in older groups. The vaccine's developers and regulators in the United Kingdom have strongly defended its efficacy in all age groups. going further, the German authorities, who had assessed only that efficacy had not yet been demonstrated for over 65s, Emmanuel Macron suggested the vaccine was less useful in the immediate crisis at hand. Macron said, "We have to be realistic. The real problem with the AstraZeneca vaccine is that it doesn't work in the way we expected. We have very little information, but all the indications today are that it is quasi ineffective for those over the age of 65. Our vaccine strategy is to inoculate health workers and the elderly because it is they who have the most serious symptoms. Today, when I look at our hospitals, 80% of patients with COVID-19 are over the age of 65, and 2/3 of those in intensive care units are over 65. Emmanuel Macron continued by saying, "The AstraZeneca vaccine is no doubt superb in the long term, and it will be useful, but it's not exactly what we need today." In further critical remarks, President Macron added, "AstraZeneca is not a vaccine-producing company. I have a lot of respect for the researchers who have tried to participate in the collective effort. They have done great research at Oxford, but they clearly have problems with the development, as we have seen. We hope that this can be improved." Macron said it was not his role to question other countries' vaccination policies, but he did suggest the British government was playing fast and loose with their science by extending the period between the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses to 12 weeks. When you read all the health notices, when even the producers say that for it to work there has to be 2 injections, which is the case with the Pfizer vaccine, when you listen to the scientists, I'm not sure you can say you are vaccinating when you have had the first injection of a vaccine that needs 2 injections, he said. Emmanuel Macron added, "If, and I say if because I don't have the figures, you inoculate the over 65s with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and if, as I have heard it, it may only be around 10% effective, then your figures make no sense. What I do know, because it is established, is that if you give 2 injections of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine 28 days apart, then you're covered at 90% level." President Macron appeared to be referring to an article in the German business newspaper Handelsblatt, which claimed the rate was only 8% in over 65s. The Handelsblatt report has been widely challenged as incorrect, including by the German Health Ministry, which suggested it had mixed up the efficacy rate for the over 65s with a proportion of older people involved in the AstraZeneca trials of the vaccine. Emmanuel Macron added, "We have to find a balance. I'm not in favor of abandoning all precautions. We have to rely on good science. If we have vaccine programs that don't respect the science, that's a problem for me. It's putting our citizens in possible danger." Meanwhile, Chris Whitty, Britain's chief medical officer, has said delaying the second dose of a vaccine was a public health decision based on the best advice and balance of risks. But the move has proved controversial. Whilst there is evidence from trials that a 12-week gap does not reduce the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, Pfizer has stressed it has no data on whether protection after the first dose of the vaccine is sustained after 3 weeks. Asked about the cross-channel blame game over not just vaccines but Brexit and coronavirus controls, in which Emmanuel Macron is often personally named, Macron laughed off the personal attacks. He said, "Whenever there is a problem with the European Union, the British just love to detest the French and me and say we are responsible. I've accepted this role sometimes. When there are tensions, I ask, why me? It is perhaps making me out to be more important than I really am." On a more serious note, Emmanuel Macron added, "I like your country a lot, but as I have already said, I think Brexit is an error. I respect the sovereignty of the people, and the people voted, so it had to be done. But I think that vote was based on a lot of lies, and now we see it has made things much more difficult in many ways.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. One of the key aspects of Islam is, you know, action in terms of one's beliefs. So for example, a person believes in a particular, you know, belief he has. For example, he believes in Tawheed, he believes in Nabuha, he believes in Ma'ad. For example, he believes in monotheism, he believes in the finality of the Prophet of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he believes in the day of resurrection. This is not sufficient. There is also a other side of the coin that must also interact with these beliefs. For example, if a person has these particular beliefs, which are the principal beliefs of a Muslim, it must be accompanied with action. And again, we see that there's a very beautiful tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam which mentioned this, but it also has a very deep and profound meaning to it. The Imam alayhi salam says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will not accept the action of an individual except if it is accompanied, or rather when it is accompanied with ma'rifah. Ma'rifah is the deep understanding of the knowledge, or rather deep knowledge of that particular act of why you are doing it. And the Imam then continues and says something even more profound, and says there is no ma'rifah, there is no deep knowledge except with action. So we see there is a reciprocal nature between these two. And there are many other traditions in the corpus of the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that indicate that between action and knowledge, there is this reciprocal nature. It is not, as we know, or a circular argument. No, it is not like that. What we mean by this, and what the Imam is trying to tell us, that when one's belief increases, his actions according to that belief should increase. When those actions increase, rather those acts of worship increase, his knowledge by way of understanding that act and by understanding those beliefs also increases. So there's an increase on the previous ma'rifah. So it's not the same ma'rifah, it is a higher form of ma'rifah and knowledge, which then leads to further action. And again, we see it's a kind of spiral, but an upward spiral. An upward spiral in the increase of both the knowledge, rather only knowledge. Ma'rifah is a very difficult word to translate. Ma'rifah means a deep knowledge and understanding of one's beliefs, of one's reasons for performing such acts. And when that increases, the act itself, not in terms of quantity, what is important is the quality of that particular act. That quality of that particular act will increase and become to a higher level and to a higher state. Hence we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to both increase us in ma'rifah, which is the deep knowledge, especially of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to also then increase the quality of our acts of worship. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
The debate.
The European Union and British-based pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca have become embroiled in a fierce